WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is poet and rock singer and songwriter Jim Carroll. His first book, Basketball Diaries, chronicled his life growing up in Manhattan from ages 13 to 15. He begins as a promising basketball player on a scholarship to a New York prep school, but by just a few pages in, he's shooting up heroin and street hustling. Jack Kerouac said of an early draft of Basketball Diaries that at age 13, Jim Carroll writes better prose than 89% of the novelists working today. Carroll continued writing his diaries in the early 70s when he was a fixture in the downtown art scene and worked for Andy Warhol. Penguin Books has just published his diaries from 1971 to 73 in a book called Forced Entries. During this period, Carroll was strung out on heroin. He later moved to California, where the methadone program had a better reputation than New York's. By the end of the book, he's clean and returns to Manhattan. Since that time, Carroll has become a rock performer. He was given his start by his friend Patti Smith. He's released three albums, including Catholic Boy and I Write Your Name. In addition to publishing Forced Entries, Penguin Books has re-released Basketball Diaries and two of his books of prose and poems. Jim Carroll, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
I'd like to give our listeners a sense of what you were writing about and what your writing was like when you were 13 and starting to keep your diaries. Can you read an excerpt that I've chosen from the Basketball Diaries?
Okay. This is from winter 1964. Suppose I was just turning like 13 or so. I never did write about the time I took my first shot of heroin. It was about 2 months back. And the funny part is I thought heroin was a non-addictive stuff and marijuana was addictive. I only found out later that a dumb move it was. I mean, funny, I could remember what vows I'd made never to touch any of that stuff when I was 5 or 6. Now, with all my friends doing it, all kinds of vows drop out from under me every day. That day I went down the cellar of Tony's building. All sorts of characters were in the storage room, shooting gallery, cooking up and getting off. I was just going to sniff a bag, but Tony said I might as well skin pop it. I said, okay. Then Pudgy said, well, listen, man, if you're going to put a needle in, you might as well mainline it and get the rush. I was scared to main, but I gave in. Pudgy hid an in for me. I did half a fiver and, oh, God, what a rush. Just one long heat wave all through my body. Any ache I had flushed out. You can never top that first rush. It's like 10 orgasms. After a half hour of nods and slow rapping, I shot the rest of the bag, this time myself. I was high even the next morning waking up. So, as simple as a walk to that cellar, I lost my virgin veins.
And that was written in 1964 by my guest Jim Carroll. You said all your friends were doing it, and it's hard to understand how 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds get exposed to the drug scene.
Well, actually, most of these guys these guys were a bit older, you know. It was different at those times. It wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. And actually, most of my friends who were, you know, 12, 13, 14... well, this is when I was living down the Lower East Side of Manhattan before I moved. Through most of the Basketball Diaries, I had moved up to like a very Irish Catholic neighborhood and on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. All the kids were just into alcohol, you know, it was just drinking. So at that time, since drugs, first of all, I mean, it's obvious from this excerpt that there wasn't much drug education around since... I mean, it was ridiculous that I thought that grass was addictive and junk was... I didn't think about junk. I just associated from, like, movies, people smoking opium. So the act of smoking a drug seemed like the addictive thing, you know. So it was kind of, you know, most guys were drinking. You had to seek out these strange little subcultures to get the guys using drugs.
A lot of people have gotten hooked on heroin because they thought they were buying into an artistic vision. And I'm thinking in jazz, for instance, a lot of jazz musicians started shooting up heroin because Charlie Parker did it, and they thought they would become more a part of the scene and maybe even a better musician if they shot up. And in writing, a lot of people, I think, started doing drugs because people who they had admired had done drugs. Did you feel like you were buying into some kind of artistic vision or scene through doing it?
No, not then, because I had, this was, I think in about the middle of the Basketball Diaries, I start speaking about after I had a scholarship to this very posh private school, and the whole sense of the intellect was different there. You know, to me, poetry was just, when I was growing up in my neighborhood, everybody thought of it as like kind of some sissy thing, you know. I felt the same way until I got turned on to like Frank O'Hara and Allen Ginsberg when I went to this private school. But that was after this time. The only reason, I mean, the only interest I had in writing them was like through the diaries, and that was mainly because the one good thing in Catholic school, I had this brother who was my teacher who got me into being the sports writer for the school newspaper and taught me a lot about similes and metaphors. And I wanted to be a journalist, you know. So as far as, like, you know, I had never read Burroughs by then, you know, who would be a logical, you know, analogy to a jazz guy emulating Charlie Parker. But to me, it was just like, it was my drug of choice, which I realized, you know. I experimented with a lot of drugs after that. But, you know, there was, by the end of the book, that it ends with me kind of having my first habit. There's something to, it's very, very organized drug. It's good to get things together on it, but I didn't actually write many of the diaries when I was stoned, you know. I liked it more when I felt more open about writing when I was straight, you know.
You were very good at basketball when you were young, and it takes a lot of physical strength and health in order to be an athlete. At what point in your life did the two start being at odds with each other, your interest in sports and your interest in drugs?
Of course, people always thought that I kind of ruined my athletic career by drugs. I think it was more my interest, when I started to get interested in poetry and decided when I was about 15 I wanted to be a poet, that's what took away my desire to play ball anymore. You know, I mean, more than drugs. The thing was, I when I found out heroin was addictive, of course, I kind of stopped. Maybe, you know, then I'd start drinking a bottle of Robitussin, you know, codeine cough syrup or something every 2 weeks on a weekend with some friends, you know. Aside from the rush, it actually was the best nod you could get, you know. It was better than heroin. Of course, your tolerance built up and stuff, but I wasn't doing it that much. I was able to maintain during the school year, actually. I wouldn't get high before games or anything like that, you know. I still loved basketball, and even after I got into poetry, I still loved the game for what I was doing, like playing in school, but I didn't have the ambitions to go beyond that like I always did before, you know. I mean, the end of my vision was the pros when I was young.
My guest is Jim Carroll, if you're just joining us. He's a poet and writer whose books have just been reissued by Penguin. They've published his diaries from when he was a teenager. One book of his diaries is called The Basketball Diaries, and the latest book is called Forced Entries. When you were a teenager and trying to get heroin, you'd end up in really dangerous places. You even ended up stealing from other junkies, which is a very, very dangerous thing to do. And I wonder why you were never really scared. I wonder why people aren't scared by crime away from doing drugs.
That's kind of in forced entries, I think, when I started to talk about taking off. In fact, what happened was the guy walked in, and the guy in front of me we went to take off a guy, and the guy before me got offed, you know, because the dealer who we were going to take off was waiting for us. And I thought, God, that could have been me. And that's the next day I got on a methadone program. And because I wasn't into the violent scene, I couldn't, in the Basketball Diaries, I spoke about, you know, like ripping off a guy, you know, in Fort Tryon Park and up in Manhattan, and I couldn't do that scene. I felt like I just wasn't comfortable with it, you know. I think what my solution was that I was pretty enough to hustle. So I'd hustle guys to make money. It seemed like less of, you know, like no one was getting hurt by it. It was not my favorite thing to do, but I was probably the worst hustler of all time, you know. But I think that, I suppose for a lot of people, when you really get desperate physically for junk, I mean, you're going to do anything. But I kind of was always able through all of it to skirt somehow and hustle and not get involved with the guys who are running in packs real heavy in violence, you know. Most guys run in partners with dope, you know, and will do things to get off, you know, to get money. I mean, but I was pretty much a loner with that, and I'd find some way to do it, you know.
I know when I was a kid, I used to keep a diary, and I'd write things about, like, what I brought to school for lunch and who I sat next to in an auditorium. But to me, this was really personal stuff, and I'd lock it up every night and hide it in a drawer in case, you know, my parents found it. And I'm thinking I was writing about the most harmless stuff, and here you are keeping a diary about being a junkie, about hustling on the streets. Where did you keep what you were writing so that people wouldn't find it?
I just kept my notebook right around in my desk drawer there. You know, I had this little, my brother and I shared a bedroom, and we had these little tiny desks, you know, and I had my school stuff, and I just have it in there, you know. I didn't expect my mother was going to go through and read something. Now, if it was in some kind of like a girl's diary with a lock on it and everything, that's when you're tempted to read it, you know? But since it was just in some kind of anonymous notebook, most of the things, I didn't really, you know, worry about it ever.
Did any adults in your life, parents or teachers, try to get you off drugs? And if so, did any of that speak to you? Did any of it help at all?
A few poet friends did at certain points. And I suppose, well, a lot of friends of mine. I remember the wife of a good friend of mine. Well, she was a very good friend of mine. She was the wife of a very well-known painter who had a problem with drugs early on. And she said that you're just going to wind up like him. And since I knew him well, I could see where she was coming from. And then a lot of poet friends like Ann Waldman. I remember Ginsberg always telling me, why don't you get into, why don't you become a Jesus freak if you don't want to be a Buddhist? You know? So I mean, things like that. It didn't register, though. There was a guy, though, Frank Lemer, a poet in New York, who was a junkie for a long time, right, and then did hard time, but was such a good poet that people like de Kooning, you know, signed petitions, and Senator Javits got him out of the joint. He backslid after 8 years of, like, not doing any junk and started to run again. And then he really cleaned up and became, like, the head of a real fanatical program to stay clean. And he spoke to me in really serious terms one night, and that did have an effect on me because, I mean, he knew where he was coming from. And that did give me an incentive to go to California because I could see there was no way I was going to do it in New York, not
Why
the
couldn't
methadone
you kick
programs.
In New York? Why couldn't you kick in New York?
Well, the methadone programs in New York, I think, it's a setup. I mean, it's for the city, not for the people on them. I mean, at the very least, they're there so that you're, first of all, they're putting you on the highest dose. The so-called counselors don't encourage you to detox. They want you on the highest dose because it keeps the crime rate down. If you're taking a lot of methadone, then you're not going to steal color TVs and get back on junk, you know. I mean, you don't feel junk if you're on 80 milligrams of methadone. Now, they used to give you 120 milligrams of methadone then until doctors finally said that's much too much. And guys who had jobs working in factories started to nod out at the old, buzzsaw. So, at its worst, it's conspiratorial in the sense that you're not going to be a revolutionary if you're strung out on methadone in Harlem.
My guest is writer Jim Carroll, and he's the author of the book Basketball Diaries and the book The Downtown Diaries. The Basketball Diaries cover his life from the mid-60s, and the forced entries, The Downtown Diaries, from 71 to 73. Both of these books have just been brought out by Penguin Books, and we're going to talk more about his life when we return after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet and rock musician Jim Carroll is my guest. His first book, The Basketball Diaries, chronicled his life growing up in Manhattan, addicted to heroin by the time he was 13. His latest book, Forced Entries, covers the period of his life from 1971 to 73, when he kicked his habit. You told us before that you were interested in heroin before you were interested in writing. But I know for some performers and writers, taking drugs sometimes seems to enhance your talent. You know, it might seem like you're playing better or writing better, I guess because you're feeling better, or you think you're feeling better if you're high. But did you go through that? Did you go through thinking that drugs was making you a better artist?
No, I think that's a specious notion. I mean, it's even worse with musicians with coke, you know. There was a drug that I never liked, though. I mean, in Forced Entries, I wrote the big thing was in the old days was doing speedballs, doing a shot of coke mixed with heroin. And I always thought, I wrote that that was like, to me, putting coke in with good heroin was like spreading applesauce in a good pork chop. It was like, I just wanted the essential pure rush. I never found that, I think I was very cautious not to let myself fall into something where I felt comfortable writing on drugs. Like I said, with heroin, it was good for getting your notebooks together. Because, I mean, you know, it's a friendly drug. It gets things in, you know, it slows things down. This is why you could see all a jive for what it is, you know. And what it does is, I mean, in a work sense, it does help you to clean out your notebooks and type up things and get a manuscript neatly together. But as far as, like, letting, you know, I rely on voice in my prose and in my poetry. I rely on imagery and lyricism, and I can't, you know, I just cut that short with, I'm depriving myself of something if I'm with heroin on that. I mean, because
I have
it's
to say,
too much control.
I'm surprised to hear you say anything positive about the drug.
That I'm not saying anything positive?
I'm surprised that you are saying something positive about it.
Oh, I mean, you know, I can't deny that it was, you know, I mean, what, the drug hit me right, you know, I enjoyed it, you know, I mean, I still remember, I could look at the worst drug propaganda shows and still remember, and it would still sometimes make me think, oh, boy, it was great, you know, but, I mean, then I remember, you know, not even the downside, the real bad physical withdrawals, and it was hideous, you know. I mean, almost things that are laughable, like, you know, sneezing for a week straight every 5 or 6 seconds. That is no fun. I never got, like, that horrible nausea. I'd get this horrible feeling like my brains were loose in my head, and I'd get hot and cold flashes shooting out the top of my head, and it was just, but the worst part was just that horrible thing where you weren't getting high anymore, you were just shooting every day to get straight, and you were just nowhere. And I mean, it's a drug that really, though I say it's a friendly high, it's not a friendly drug, because it turns on you like all drugs, you know, but God, I mean, you know, there was a certain warmth to it that lasted a while, and I can't, if I denied that, then I'd, you know, why would I have gotten into it in the first place, you know? I can't fool myself enough to say, to not remember the good part of it, you know?
In the beginning of your latest book, Forced Entries, you quote Anatole France, who says, "All writers of confessions from Augustine on down have always remained a little in love with their sins." Does that describe how you feel about your past?
Well, I mean, not in the vein, so to speak, of what we've been talking about. I mean, not in a drug sense, but that's something that's, well to be gone. But I think in the sense of, say, just like the thrill I used to get when I was younger of that sense of walking around Times Square at night, feeling, and being totally anonymous, and the possibilities for the strangest encounters, I mean, those things, you knew something was going to happen, and something usually would, but it wasn't what happened. It was the feeling before that, just you were chasing after something, and that feeling was something I miss,
You were writing about experiences on drugs and writing a lot about getting drugs. When you gave up drugs, did that take away for a while your subject matter? Did you have to totally rethink your identity, both as a person and as a writer?
Oh, no. I don't think so at all. I mean, I have hardly any references to drugs in my poems. I wrote one poem called Heroin that really has nothing to do with heroin, except the fact that the whole landscape is miniaturized in it. But it's not in a subjective sense. It's not about heroin. And I didn't have to rethink anything. My life was, I live very much in my mind, and my images come from someplace that can pierce the veil of drugs, I mean, hopefully. I mean, I rely on some kind of purer state than that that I'm reaching for when I write.
You've written that you expected to be dead when you by the age of 20.
And I didn't. A lot of people who I was around did.
But you wrote that not dying young can be a dilemma, is what you wrote.
Yeah, I was being a bit facetious there.
What do you mean?
Well, I meant that when people expect that of you, you have to come up with... At that point, I felt that I had to come up with a whole new trick. I mean, in my life, that part was gone. I was a knowledge freak. I wanted to learn things, And what I had to do and what I did in California while I was getting off drugs, I mean, the most important thing I learned in California was not about getting off drugs. That was a very painful thing. But the most important thing was to take all the knowledge and even the learned trivia that I learned in details from the poets I was hanging around with. I have a line in Forced Entries where I say, I was listening to Ginsberg and W.H. Auden, and I say, I have a lot more pickups to make before I start making any deliveries. So the point was, in California, I was by myself for the first time in my life in kind of a reclusive sense, and I was able to transform all of that detail, all that knowledge into wisdom, because I was concentrating more on principles rather than detail. And that was, that was how I turned the trick from, transforming youth into something beyond youth.
What I'm wondering? There's such concern in the country now about drugs, and there's the whole Just Say No campaign. I wonder what you think of campaigns like that, and if you think that they're effective in keeping younger people away from drugs.
I don't know if it's effective. I think that, for one thing, I find it's very impolite. I mean, if she should at least say, don't say no, she should say, no, thank you. But I think that I'm speaking Nancy Reagan. I mean, who is really going to listen to Nancy Reagan talking about drugs? I mean, no matter how many times she goes and sees the way drug clinics are run in Sweden or something while her husband's over at a summit, you know, she has, I mean, the drug program's fundings are being cut every year.
What would have been, do you think it's not effective to say that to teenagers?
I suppose, I mean, you can't say yes to drugs, you know, because they're a horrible thing, and it's much more of a problem now than when I was young. I mean, it's so available, and I mean, you know, crack is just like, you know, I mean, I've seen guys who, you know, who knew how to know from experience how to handle drugs, just get, you know, out of their senses within a week from that stuff. So, I mean, you know, that's where the real demons coming in, you know. And I don't have answers to those things, you know. I think that you can't be sloganistic about it. It's a terrible thing to say, but I suppose everybody has to hit bottom before they realize it in their own way, you know. I mean, because sometimes, I mean, you only, I don't know, there's some kind of reverse thing that happens with drugs when you start saying things like that to people, you know. Also, it's all just from a political stance. I mean, if they're going to invade Grenada, why can't they just clean up the drug trafficking from Bermuda, you know?
Has anyone expressed concern to you that they thought that your books would glamorize drugs in any way?
No. Some rock critics with some of my songs in my first album. But I mean, like a line from the song City Drops Into the Night, I say it's when the body at the bottom, that body is my own reflection, but it ain't hip to sink that low unless you're going to make a resurrection. I mean, there's nothing glamorous about being in that pit. The only thing heroic about it is having the chance, it gives you the chance to actually reclaim and take a second chance at life, which very few people, I mean, that's an incredible cathartic experience that few people can experience, but that's the only thing heroic about it is climbing out of that slime. Otherwise, you're just dealing with a lot of psychological paraphernalia, and it's bad news.
Jim Carroll, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Okay.
And poet and rock musician Jim Carroll has been my guest. His first book, The Basketball Diaries, chronicled his life growing up in Manhattan, addicted to heroin by the time he was 13. His latest book, Forced Entries, just published by Penguin, covers the period of his life from 1971 to 73 when he kicked his habit. Penguin has also just published two books of his poems.